Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For roughly 6 weeks, Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowy has been at the center of an independent investigation into his residency. The council member, who represents District 2, has been accused of not living in the district he was elected to serve, which is against the law, and instead living in neighboring Placer County in his wife's Granite Bay home. Council member Lalowy has denied these allegations, first reported by the Sacramento Bee, since the very beginning, saying that he lives permanently at the North Sacramento home off Nogales Street, where he is also registered to vote. But now there's another development. Police records obtained by CAP Radio show that there have been 9 complaints at the North Sacramento residence Councilmember Lalowy owns and says he lives at 7 days a week. Those records were obtained by CAP Radio news editor Chris Hooks, who joins us now in studio. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Vicki. How's it going?
So the last time you joined us was at the end of June. You explained the independent investigation surrounding Councilmember Lalowy, which we just laid out. Walk us through your legwork and reporting in the weeks since then.
Yes, I mean, I think some credit also goes to Teresa Cliff with the Sacramento Bee, who, to your point, initially broke the story of whether or not he lives in that house. But since then, obviously, we've done some reporting, talking to some community members in there who have requested that independent investigation. Myself personally, requested quite a bit of records. This is sort of a first taste of some of the records that I did request. But since then, obviously, 6 weeks doesn't really feel like 6 weeks, but we know that there's an investigation going on. We don't know who's doing the investigation for the city. We don't know what specifically they're looking at. But a lot of the legwork is really talking to the people in the community and really looking for records to see if this is happening.
Yeah.
To see if this is true.
Yeah, you and I were just talking about how 6 weeks really just flew by. I had to look at the calendar to actually confirm when you last joined us about this development. So what led you to file the public records request concerning police records? Did you receive a tip?
Well, initially I'd seen someone posted photos on Twitter of police cars at the house in Nogales Street, and saw that. Went to the Public Records Center immediately, filed a public records request, and that's what came about. It came in my email yesterday, actually.
You were showing me those police complaints earlier this morning. Can you run through the complaints that police received at the home of Councilmember Lalowy, the one that he owns and says that he lives at permanently?
Yeah, so the first one came June 20th of 2019, which is a few months after he bought the house. That one was just a simple call for an alarm, the house alarm going off. Months later, you have some of the more interesting ones. Obviously, you have the one in November of a disturbance between a buyer and a seller of a vehicle. Seller or the buyer of the car says the seller wouldn't refund his purchase after the engine wouldn't start an hour after he bought the car. Then a year after that, a stolen vehicle report, someone stealing the car from the house because the previous owner still had keys. In 2021, you have loud music, parties, firework complaints. And then for about a week straight in 2021, from July 31st to August 4th, you have suspicious subject entering a home carrying a weapon, upset about the music volume for a party. You have on August 1st, noise disturbance. On August 2nd, police come to the house to show the people who live there, the person who lives there, a photo lineup of potential suspects for a previous incident. And then on August 4th, you have police saying that a caller saying that there was someone who entered the house with a gun. And then most recently, this one is in February, was just someone calling from the house, calling 911, but hanging up.
And to be clear, these complaints don't actually detail who officers actually spoke with at the home, right?
They do not, no.
Yeah. It's important also to make clear that even here at Inside of You as well, we've made multiple attempts to interview Councilmember Lalowy for the past 6 weeks. And up until now, we've pretty much only had the initial emailed statement denying the allegations that he didn't live at the home in the district that he served. But he did talk to you this time. Were you surprised by that?
I was. I mean, he's previously left me on read on text. Sent my phone to voicemail a few times. I've left him a few voicemails, no returns. Sent him several emails. He responded to one email saying to reach out to his PR people. Reached out to them. They didn't respond. So, you know, it's been a lot of that over the past 6 weeks. And I truthfully was surprised that he answered my phone call this morning or last night.
So what was his response to these police complaints?
All but one he denied, said essentially that they were false.
Let's take a listen.
None of them have ever happened. And I'm the only one that lives, I mean, from day one, I've lived in that house. I bought it brand new. So, I'm making a note on this. You said there's police reports about guns?
Yeah. So you did say that he did acknowledge one complaint. Which one was that?
So it's unclear if he doesn't give an exact date of which one it was. So it's unclear because he says that, you know, he had a party sometime last year. We know that there are several complaints about people calling 911 about noise complaints and parties at that house. So it's unclear which exact one, but he does say that there was one time where he had a party and one of his guests saw someone with a gun enter the house.
So I had a big party at the house, and then one of my guests thought somebody walked in and it looked like they had a gun. Not one of our guests, just a random person. By the time I looked around, I didn't see anybody, so I called the police and told them about the situation. And I do remember, because I had a party there.
And do you remember when that was?
It was last year sometimes, if I'm not mistaken. I just don't remember the exact.
Okay, so aside from this complaint of a noise complaint and also someone reporting that there was a firearm inside the home while he was having a party, he's staying firm on one, the fact that he lives in the home, he lives there 7 days a week, and that two, that the other eight complaints are new to him, the ones that you were talking about, you know, surrounding vehicles. How does he reconcile those two claims? Because they kind of seem pretty far apart. How do you live at that home and then also deny claims that police received police complaints at the home that you're living at 7 days a week?
I mean, just based on our conversation, I'm not sure how he does. He really just keeps repeating and insists that, you know, the reports that we received from the city, again, I should note that they're false. They're incorrect. None of those things, except for the one of the party, happened. And he just kept saying that over and over again, essentially. When I, you know, asked specifically about some of the other incidents, he denied those happened. He said he was surprised about those things, that he wanted to call the chief of police and figure out what was going on with these reports. And I think it's you either have to, for him, you know, say that these reports didn't happen, say that they did, and, you know, recognize that a lot of parties happen at this house, his house that he says he lives in, or continue saying that I live there and these things happen, or come out and say that I don't live there. So it's, you know, he has to figure out on the phone call which of those he wants to do. And as you can tell, he denies all of these things happen.
This is all information based on calls that came from the house and police responding to calls from the house.
No, it's all false. There was one incident that I can verify myself that I had a big party at the house. And then, as I told you, one of my guests, and when I say big, it was a pretty big party. We had live music and everything. And I wanted to guess, thought some random person walked in and it looked like they had a gun. So right away, I called the police and they came and I talked to them and that was it. But that's the only time that a call has been made since I've owned that house, which has been since 2018.
And was the guest that thought they saw a gun, was that someone who frequents the house? Frequents the house enough to maybe, you know, recognize the person with the gun?
No.
Was the person who your guest thought was anyone related to, you know, any previous accidents or incidents at the house?
No, because there's never been an incident at the house. So that's why I'm very intrigued that there's 9 reports from the police department. So I'm definitely going to call the chief to see what's going on this. And I appreciate you calling me, telling me this, because this is all false information.
Okay, Chris. So this piece of the story is really just the beginning. Your story was published late last night. Where do you take it from here?
Last night after I got off the call, obviously, we also put in some more records requests for official police reports, ones that he, at this point, are denying happened. And police, in a response to my records request, said they could not release because of investigatory reasons. Waiting for those to come. So it's putting in more requests and putting a little more pressure to see if we can get that information.
Yeah. We can't ignore the fact that all this week we've been sharing reporting from North Sacramento following a year of listening sessions with CAP Radio and residents in that district who have long said that they felt neglected by the city, that they shoulder more than their share of the city's issues like homelessness, affordable housing, lack of services for youth, essentially the city investing around District 2 but not within District 2. How does this story, given that that's his district, fit into the concerns of a historical lack of investment in District 2?
Well, I think it just represents for the people living there that sort of what they've thought all along, that no one really is there to help support them in various ways. You know, you have a sitting council member who represents that district who says that he lives in the district, but reports show otherwise. And you know, to really understand a district and to represent a district, the point of, you know, having a city council representative is having someone who shares a lot of lived experiences with you in that district. And for some of the people living in that district, knowing or thinking and assuming that, you know, the person who represents you and your interests doesn't actually live where you live and instead may live in a $1 million home in Granite Bay in a neighboring county miles from us, from their district. It just represents exactly what they've thought all along.
Chris, thanks for sharing your reporting.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Vicky.
And you can read his article at capradio.org. That is CAP Radio News Editor Chris Hooks. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sex trafficking has received growing attention in recent years, especially since Congress passed the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act of 2000. But 20-some years isn't necessarily a lot of time. There is limited research in knowing the prevalence from one community to the next, because trafficking is a crime that is hidden and can happen gradually over time. Sacramento County founded what it calls a first-of-its-kind study in California, and the numbers will give you pause. From 2015 to 2020, the study found in Sacramento County more than 13,000 victims of sex trafficking, a number that is likely an underestimate. The research also included interviewing more than 150 survivors with the goal of prevention and creating the right resources. I spoke with three guests who each played a key role. Dr. Shannon Williams is with the Institute for Social Research at Sacramento State. Terry Galvan is with the nonprofit Community Against Sexual Harm, also known as the acronym CASH, and Sacramento City Council member Eric Guerra, who helped lock down the state funding for this project. This is an unprecedented study that was released, not only in Sacramento County, but in the state of California. I would really love to just start off with the origin story. What prompted a study of this nature?
Well, it comes from just being a neighbor in Sacramento. I mean, I live near Stockton Boulevard, and many of us drive by every day. And Stockton Boulevard, like many commercial corridors in Sacramento County, whether it's, you know, Florin or Watt, Fulton, you know, Franklin, all of these corridors, we have human trafficking, sex trafficking specific, happening in right in front of us, in front of communities. Unfortunately, it's modern-day slavery. Terry had showed up to a neighborhood association meeting before I got elected to the city council and started talking about the challenge of so many women that were trapped in this cycle right here in our own community. You don't have to go to another country to see the type of, you know, indentured servitude or like I said, modern-day slavery that's occurring. And so when I got on the council, we started talking about how do we support the diversion effort to help the survivors make sure that they don't fall back into that system, because many of them depended on their victimizers, their perpetrators, to stay afloat and stay alive. Young women, you know, in also some of the illegal massage parlors that were popping up as well, that contributed also to the decay of the commercial corridors. All of those pieces combined, we started, you know, thinking about, okay, I like the support of CASH. I want to make sure that we're making an actual dent in it for our city. And what we found out was this is pervasive throughout the county. When we started discussing this issue with other colleagues throughout the state, the reality was that nowhere in the state did we quite understand what the magnitude was. So I went, we said, we got to think bigger than just funding the programs here locally and figure out what is going to make systemic change. And before you can just start making change and going at it, you know, I think the proverbial, you know, analogy is, you know, you don't want to shoot then aim. We want to aim and then figure out where our target is. And so we needed to find out what the scope of sex trafficking is. And sadly, the victimization that's happened here of many of our youth, to say specifically, was a number that wasn't surprising to us, and even on the conservative side. So reached out. The Department of Justice is the one that's managing the state contract. We were able to secure, you know, over $1 million to be able to study, not just in the city of Sacramento, but in the county of Sacramento, how many people were affected.
Between 2015 and 2020, correct?
Yeah, and I think it's over 13,000 victims of sex trafficking, survivors of sex trafficking, in just that short window of time. And we're fortunate enough to have Sacramento State, you know, right here in our own community, home of Capital Public Radio, and to be able to have that expertise to help us crack this nut and solve this problem.
I'm curious what that number represents, more than 13,000 victims and survivors between 2015 and 2020. Dr. Williams, can you help me understand what that number means and what it doesn't mean?
Sure. I think that to understand the number is to, we like to put some caveats around it. So it means that that is a number of individuals who are who were trafficked at any point during that time period in Sacramento County. So it's not people who were exclusively trafficked within the county. It's people who were, but they, we, one of our criteria was that they had to have been trafficked in the county. We can't say that's the total number of people at any one point, but it is the range with our study that we know that at least 13,000 people were trafficked at some point during that time period.
And what Councilmember Guerra just said, that it likely is an undercount. Do you have any idea how much of an undercount? Because more than 13,000 human beings in Sacramento County, for me, just sounds extraordinary in and of itself.
I think that's the issue, is that there isn't a precise number. There is a range. And to understand how that number came about, I like the analogy of you have a pond and you don't know how many fish are in it. And so what we did is we counted basically how many touches across different agencies that individuals showed up. So it's sort of a catch and release where you would catch a fish, you tag it and put it in. So the more times that the fish would come up, you know that you have a smaller group of individuals. But what happened is that we had very little overlap in agencies. And so what we found was really about 11.2 times the amount of people that are actually being served in the county. And so the methodology really is designed to find these hard to count individuals.
So that number, more than 13,000, is 11 times the number previously known by law enforcement and service providers?
Yes. And it's the if you think about who we're touching in terms of our services, for every person, for example, that Cash is helping, there are 11 other individuals out there who are being trafficked.
CASH is the acronym for Community Against Sexual Harm. That is a nonprofit. And Terry, you led that nonprofit. I would imagine these numbers are not surprising to you, but if you can also just explain who these people are.
The number was not surprising to me in that we knew we were just touching the surface. But to go through the study and see the number, and in conjunction with the administrative data, we did interviews. And so then to attach these lives to this data, it was still shocking on some level. It really was. Who the people are. They are our young women. So we interviewed adult women, and the stories that came out were stories of young people. Our safety net for our young people is not strong enough. It is letting way too many people fall through and have very limited choices. So this was a story of young people, some that never escaped fully. So we were talking to older women at this time whose lives have been trapped by this with no viable way out. It is our neighbors, our children. It is an issue. 13,000 people over 5 years is a lot of community members. It really is. And so there are clearly some disproportionate impacts in low opportunity communities, in places with deep poverty. Clearly, we find that there is the intersections there. But we also just find where the safety net has been weak. We have let people fall into these cracks, to vulnerabilities that are very hard to get out of.
I believe some of the victims were as young as 14 years old.
We were interviewing adults, but it was incredibly common for the average age of starting to be somewhere between 15 and 19. It's very, very, very common.
And one of the unfortunate things, it's also many women of color. And one of the things that brought to my attention as a council member was when our police department would go into some of these illicit or illegal massage parlors. Many of them were women who had no language access. They didn't have access to a family network or support network. They were living in those locations, and so the approach was also to figure out how do we address that. The study talked about the disproportionality of this, of women of color also as well. But it touches everyone, unfortunately. And the sad part was to find out is it's our own neighbors who are buying people for their pleasure. They're buying folks and perpetuating that modern day slavery.
When reading the study and reading the interviews, the excerpts from those women who were interviewed, I believe there was more than 150. I guess just starting off, is that unprecedented? I mean, a study of this kind is already unprecedented, but actually including interview subjects of this size, more than 150, into a research study, has that been done before when trying to understand the scope of sex trafficking?
We did exclusively women who identified as having the trafficking experience. So that was unique for this study. The other thing that was very, very unique and the first of its kind was that we trained survivor leaders to do the interviews. So the quality of our interviews was very, very high, meaning the conversations that they had, I think, were very strong because of using survivor leaders to do the interviews and the model that we used. So that was a very unique aspect of this study. And that was really exciting for this project because we had many, many women say they've never talked about this. And they did talk in depth to our researchers.
Well, Terry, what goes into gaining that trust and that vulnerability?
I think that using people with lived experience with this issue and with so many of our issues that seem to be very vexing to us, I think that is a really underused strategy. I think that people are just simply more comfortable talking to people who have walked in their shoes in some fashion. When you're looking at issues that have so much stigma, there's so much marginalization around it. That is just a strategy that is successful. And it is fair to people to take the time to train people to meet them and talk to them in a way that's comfortable to them. I think that is the fair way to do this, an appropriate way to do it. And then we've been a longstanding organization in this space. I mean, while we're still a relatively young organization, considering we've been in this space exclusively for all these years. So we also interviewed in a safe space, in a comfortable space where we were also able to offer services and offer basic needs where we did the interview. So it was a very thoughtful process.
Dr. Williams, given that, you know, you're with the Institute for Social Research at Sac State and data is really your wheelhouse, when you were reading these interviews to really add a deeper layer, how did that shape the way you put this research together and how you viewed the data?
Well, I think it was a pretty impactful study for me and my team, reading the interviews and reading these stories. I think one, I came out of it with just a profound level of respect for these women who have really just survived and they've done anything they could to survive. I think also it's a really nuanced issue. And so I think if we would have sent sort of traditional researchers to say, have you been trafficked? I would have said, probably most of them would have said no. But the really unique part of this study was that it was informed by the survivors. And so the questioning was a very subtle and nuanced in the sense of talking about sort of how they got into sex trafficking. And when they start to talk about how they actually were introduced to even sex work, a lot of the women talked about how they were in a relationship and they were tricked. And they were sent to a hotel and said, you're not leaving until you make so much money. And so I think reading over and over these stories, you can see how I think the media does not really do justice of how this happens and how it could happen to really anyone. It could happen to our, you know, anyone's daughter, anyone's sister, or their sons too, because also men are trafficked and transgendered folks. So it's really not something I wish we've had a lot of conversations with the research team. I wish we could take sex out of it because it's really is a public health relational type of issue that needs to be addressed that way. And then unfortunately it does involve, you know, people who are being trafficked for sex work.
We use the word grooming. I mean, it's a gradual process. There's a lot of nuance to it. And I would imagine that's why there really isn't reliable data that exists about sex trafficking, and which probably prompted this undertaking in Sacramento County.
Exactly. And I think, you know, Terry is the expert here in terms of her career working with trafficked folks. But it is something I learned so much from these survivors and listening to their stories, and how domestic violence is just an integral part of what's going on here in relationship violence. And Terry, I'm sure you have more to add to that.
I know we checked in a lot with the research team as they were transcribing and reading the interviews one after the other, and obviously our researchers and the rest of the team, because it was tough stuff. And we're just reading it, you know, and there's just these moments where you sit with this and say, these are people's lives. These are not other people's lives. This is our community. These are people. The thing about this study was there was nowhere to go. This is our community members that we are reading about right here. And I think that was what was really important about this research, is that it doesn't let anybody say, well, we're different because of this or that. We got no wiggle room. These are our community members, our women, our men, our children, and something more needs to be done.
The point of domestic violence, I think, is also an important touch point when it comes to sex trafficking. And it's for that reason that CASH and also organizations like the Sacramento Regional Family Justice Center, WEAVE, City of Refuge, and my sister's house have all been very supportive of this effort here, because it is that not just the physical abuse, but the emotional abuse that leads to this breakdown of people being trapped in a cycle that they can't get out of. And this all kind of started in an effort to try to help victims and survivors out of that cycle. And that's how we came to the realization that we've got to get some real information in front of our state lawmakers, so that if we're ever going to make a dent in it, in our own community, we've got to hit those hard touch points of domestic violence and then understand what are going to be the things that help people out of it.
Well, Councilmember Guerra, this published and was released last month. What kind of response have you received since then?
It was very well received from people on the ground and very in the community and in the space, because you got to bear in mind when the pandemic hit. That's the other interesting point about when we started this study. It was before the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, everyone who's involved in domestic violence, human trafficking, knew that the pandemic and the close down and the shutdown and being people locked away was only going to escalate the number of people being victimized. And sure enough, once the study was released, it reminded people and it actually energized the community to say, we have to get at this, because we know that during the pandemic, this probably even exacerbated even further.
Finally, how will this research translate to meaningful change and resources and ultimately support for victims and survivors of sex trafficking? I know we're in the early stages. This was just released, you know, a couple weeks ago. But I'm just curious, for all of you, what are your hopes that this translates into? Terry, I'll start with you.
For me, this is a story of prevention. This is a story of, this is a public health issue. We have people who are victimized. We have people who exploit, and we have people who buy exploited people, all in our community. We have to take a different approach, and we really have to care about closing the gaps where people are falling in. We really have to say that it is great. My organization, we are the hardest working group, I think, and we do every single thing we can do, but we cannot prevent this. We are at the other end where things have already happened, and sometimes such terrible things have already happened that is, they're really hard to, women survive, men survive, they come out of this, but wouldn't it be great if that didn't have to be their story, that we could prevent it from the beginning? So that was going into this, that was where I was, and that's where I'm at coming out of this.
Yeah, Terry, I mean, your heart is in nonprofit work. Councilmember Guetta, you're an elected official. How would you like this study translate into meaningful solutions for this issue?
No, clearly, as Terry mentioned, it's the investment in our youth, the investment in mental health support and access for young people to understand what a healthy relationship looks like. I mean, we haven't had an opportunity with many of our young people to be exposed to healthy relationships if they're already in a place where they're facing domestic violence. And we know that that perpetuates. And so then you fall into these cycles. On the land use side, one thing we found out was we could get after the profiteering of people who were using facilities or locations to make money off of it. And how do we go as a city or as a county to go after those profiteers who maybe are turning a blind eye to sex trafficking happening on their property and making a buck out of it? And then one, stop being punitive to the survivors and figure out how to get them out of it. So on the back end, as we are helping people out of this, let's figure out how to get them back on their feet. And a lot of those issues are things that we're facing now, the cost of housing, the fact that many of them don't have any skills or training. So the study will help us inform the gaps in our education, our public policy system, our education system, our housing system, to be able to make some meaningful change. And fortunately, we have a great university like Sac State that's helping a lot of those issues out.
Well, that brings me to you, Dr. Williams. I mean, do you hope that this research serves as a template for more research to be done, not only throughout California, but across the country?
Yes, I would love to see that. And I think as an applied research center, I think that we are going to continue working with CASH and the research team and the advisory council to really sort of solidify how you use people with lived experience as experts, as really the focal point for designing the study and implementing it. So I'm really excited to see how we can take this a little further, maybe even apply it to different populations. And so I see it as just the beginning.
And that is my conversation with Dr. Shannon Williams with the Institute for Social Research at Sacramento State, Terry Galvan with the nonprofit Community Against Sexual Harm, also known by the acronym CASH, and Sacramento City Council member Eric Guetta, discussing a new study into the scope of sex trafficking in Sacramento County. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. With everything going on in the world and here at home, we all deserve a break from the news, right? So we decided to set aside our last segment of the week to talk wine. Not so much about the business of wine, but to get down and dirty about what we like, what's good this time of year, and what we can expect in the upcoming harvest. And with that, we welcome back to Insight, Rick Cushman. Rick is a New York Times bestselling author, former Sacramento Bee columnist and longtime Insight contributor, and knows a thing or two about wine. Welcome back, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy wine season, wine tasting season.
Yes, yes. Actually, today is my anniversary. I hope my husband is listening. Maybe get some tips on what we can have later on tonight.
Get her a lovely sparkling. It's always the first place to go.
I love sparkling. You know, in preparation for this segment, the Insight team was talking about the kind of wine that they like, and it really can vary, and there's no judgment. You can head up to Napa Valley and then, or even like boxed wine. So
yes,
there's something for everyone.
Yes. Well, you know, I have two rules of wine. First one is if you love it, you're right. If you hate it, you're right. And the second one is wear dark colors.
Yeah, that is a great idea. I have made that mistake one or two times.
Right. That's all you really need to know. And then there are no wrong answers.
Yeah. Why is now a great time to wine taste in Northern California? I mean, I love harvest season.
Yes. Well, and so does everybody else. And so there's two things going on. One, crush is just starting. It's a little tiny bit early, but not horribly early. But it's still a bit early, which does all kinds of things. One, the regions start to smell like wine. You know, you get into Napa Valley or in Shenandoah Valley, you know, which is up above Plymouth and Amador, or some of those places where they're heavy with wineries, and you literally can smell like the crush going on. You can smell the pulp and the grapes, and it's wonderful. But also because it is popular, that the wineries set it up for that. So they expect to have visitors. They expect to show you a lot. You can even taste baby wine, which is, you know, wine in getting, you know, as it's fermenting, which is kind of cool if you've never seen it before, especially the smaller wineries. It's in, like, it'll be in, you know, not stuff in the tanks, but if they're doing it in a barrel, it's fizzing and popping. That's our little friend's yeast eating the sugar and creating alcohol and CO2. And they may let you taste it, and it's super sweet, by the way, because wine grapes are actually way sweeter than regular grapes.
Yeah, the first time I actually did that, it was in Morgan Hill. It was many years ago, and it was such a treat,
Knowing
that you could actually taste wine when it's still in the barrel and still kind of getting its personality and character.
Yeah, I was on a tour, and there was a couple of people tasting with it. When you taste that stuff, one guy goes, "Wow, this stuff is great. You should sell it." And they go, "Well, we do. We call it wine."
We call it wine. So given that it's still summer and we're heading into the weekend, how should people plan for wine tasting in Northern California? It can be kind of overwhelming. You don't have to go to Napa or Sonoma, but you got the foothills. You even have the Delta as well.
Yeah, you have wine tasting in every direction. But a quick couple of overall tips for everything is it is still summer. You know, and we were talking this morning, listening to Donna talk about the weather, and she says, well, it's still cool. It's in the low 90s. Well, 90s is low 90s is not cool for wine. Really, anything over the high 70s, you can cook your wine. And so, I say this every time, is always like bring a cooler. Just a little styrofoam cooler or anything if you got a decent cooler and throw in a couple things of ice. So if you buy wine, you know, from one place to the next, you'll make it home. The second one is when you go tasting, my suggestion is, if you could possibly do this, is don't let them tell you the tasting notes. And in fact, don't read the tasting notes for two reasons. Wine's a creature of suggestion. So if it says it's going to taste like cherries and blackberries, you'll be looking for cherries and blackberries. And you may actually taste that in there. But part of it is that they'll tell you it tastes like something. And if it doesn't to you, your brain goes, oh, well, this wine must not be for me. I don't really like it. So if you can get them to not do that, and sometimes that's hard, you know, but then it tastes the wine. And the one question you ask yourself is simply, do you like it?
Yeah.
That's the question. That's the end, you know, and if you want to start then figuring out why, go for it. But you kind of have to fight that urge to try to be a wine geek, because wine is not about geekiness. Wine is about having fun.
Yeah, and it can take away from the experience,
yes,
especially if you're not into, you know, kind of, you know, that quote unquote wine snobbiness. You just want to drink it and enjoy it. And also when you're tasting, it depends on what you eat before and,
yes,
and what tasting it is, actually, that can change the way you taste the wine.
Yes, and everybody tastes something different. And one of the fun things I do in my podcast, which is on hiatus, but is, you know, we'll open up a couple of different wine magazines on the same wine, and the descriptions are totally different. And these are wine pros. And that doesn't mean they don't like the wine or even taste a similar wine, but everybody gets something different. So the question isn't what do they get? Plus, as somebody used to write those tasting notes for some wineries, you know, they're writing very romantic descriptions of they're lovely and you'll fall in love with the wine. And fall in love with the wine or not on your own is always the best way to go.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get back to actually keeping the wine bottles at the right temperature, because I had to learn that the hard way. I mean, if you're going to a couple places, it's the summer, your car gets hot. I mean, if you can explain what that does to the wine.
So a couple of things. Wine actually, think about it. It's a liquid, and as it gets warm, and it's also got, this is air in the bottle, it expands. And so if it expands, it might push the cork out a little bit. If it pushes the cork out a little bit, among the things that happen is oxygen gets in. And that's why you cork a wine, and that's why you seal it if you've had some of it, is that the oxygen will change the wine even within a day or two. And if you ever wonder about our friend oxygen, just slice an apple and put it on your counter and look how quickly it turns brown. Mm-hmm. You know, so it does that to the wine. So that's part of it. Second is it'll change the chemistry of the wine. And then when you're hot, by the way, it also changes the chemistry of how you taste wine.
Oh, really?
So like when we are hot, we taste bitterness and sweetness more when something is hot or we're hot. And so it's one of the reasons we don't like a big cab in the summer, because it's the tannins which give it some bitterness, and it just tastes kind of wrong. And whereas other things taste a little, the sweetness might come up, which is why whites sometimes taste even more delicious, because you'll pick up the sugars and the acid, which balances it out, which does not increase in hot weather. So there's that too.
Where are some places that we should go in our area that aren't, you know, because sometimes with Napa and Sonoma, there's like that sticker shock of price, but there are affordable places, you know, within an hour drive from Sacramento.
Yeah, I love Napa. I love Sonoma. I've written a book about Napa, so I will never say anything bad about Napa, but it is super expensive.
Yeah.
And but we are in the center. There's a reason why we are farm to fork capital of America, is because we are centrally located for everything, including wine. Clarksburg is 20 minutes away, literally 20 minutes away. It feels like forever, which is nice, but it's 20 minutes away. You can go down. It's a great wine region. Go down the old Sugar Mill or Bogle down there, and they have a nice place for a picnic. And there's a bunch of little guys up along and down the levee roads. And it's never forget Clarksburg. It's so close. And then our foothills, they're an hour away, so it's closer and easier than Napa. I would say start with Amador County, because Shenandoah Valley Road is that's above Plymouth. It's like, I think it's 160 is what it's out there. And then it is like wandering through any beautiful wine country. It's hills and there's a couple of horse ranches, but mostly beautiful wineries. And so many people up there do so many good things. You know, I have some faves. Do you want to hear faves, or should we be picking?
Yeah, let's do faves.
So some,
I really like Story in Amador County.
Yeah, Story's a very, very popular one. Some of my favorites are Andis. I love Andis. The Iron Hub, which is a little way around the corner, another one of my faves up there. Diari, C.G. Diari, Scott Harvey, Rundquist is another good one up there. I have to write these down because there's so many. Sobon, Terre Rouge, Carmer.
I mean, we're talking about dozens.
Yes.
There's
dozens. And seriously, there's no bad choices up there. That's another one of the really nice things. And they charge now like $5 or $10.
And often you get to meet the owner. And I love that charm in Amador County.
Yeah. And my suggestion is go for places with really nice views. And that's why two of my favorites are both Andis and Iron Hub, because they are on hills or in areas where you just can get these really, really great little views. And then El Dorado County, which is actually sort of three areas. You know,
you have Somerset, which is kind of on the border of El Dorado and Amador.
Yeah, and that's the Fair Play area-ish. And that's kind of, if you kept on going up that road through the Amador County wineries, it's another 5-10 miles up the road. It's maybe 5 miles up the road. It's a little farther away, but there's a lot of really great little wineries there, and it's kind of forgotten. You're never going to run into crowds. And if you do go to there, go to Skinner for sure. They're up on a hill. They have their winemaker. They come from like a Pinot Noir background, so all of their wines have this silkiness
beautiful
to them.
Beautiful view.
Yeah, and there's places like Perry Creek and Windwalker and Mastrastero, which is the guy will come out and play the guitar for you. And their wine's really good. He's Italian, but he does a really really nice job with the wines like Cab and up there. It's really good. But then El Dorado County too also is like is Carson Road. You know, that's right along Highway 50, right above Placerville. Super easy to get to.
Is that kind of like the Camino area?
Yes, okay. Exactly right.
Apple
so
Hill?
It, yeah, 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 yeah. It, that is, it's Apple Hill. And so like you get off at one exit past Placerville, really in Placerville, get up to Carson Road, turn right, and you run into things like Boger, and those folks are celebrating their 50th anniversary, and they're one of the pioneers,
yeah.
And also one of the really genuinely nice families of California wine, and they're just good place to stop and a lovely place to have a picnic. And you got Lava Cap, you got I gotta look at my list because there's so many.
And I know for people who are listening, you may be getting like overstimulated, but it's so easy just to drive down. Yeah, just drive down Carson Road or just head up to Amador County, and there's so many options, and you can't really go wrong.
Yeah, I'm throwing names at you, but you know, so Google the wine region. Go to it's Edwa or El Dorado County Wine Association or Amador Vintners or same thing with our friends in Lodi. And just pick out some of your wineries. Lodi's a little tiny bit more work because they're a little less condensed. Mm-hmm. You know, you're driving down 99, you make a left. But same thing with those other regions. Anywhere you go, there's actually Lodi's turned into this really outstanding area. And Zin is one of the great things, but it's not just Zin. In fact, there actually has a cool region. So there's a lot of great whites down there. There's a winery called Acquiesce that only does whites. And they're all beautiful for the white wine lovers out there.
Yeah, and white's great right now for summer. Rick, thank you so much. I know it's like 10 o'clock. It's still the morning, but it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yes. And if you're a professional, you can start drinking wine now.
Yeah. Rick Cushman is our local wine expert and a New York Times best-selling author. Thanks again, Rick.
My pleasure.
That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.